Law enforcement and local advocates joining together in a major effort to stand with local survivors of sexual assault. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now. Video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, find out what's being done in this area to bring down rates of sexual assault and bring accused rapists to justice. We're going to tell you all about it. Give us a call now with your questions at 549-2937. Then later, helping local children on the autism spectrum with innovative therapies for local kids. Plus a preview of the new Douglas Anderson production, The Shadow Box, all of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Jacksonville leaders say they're determined to do whatever's necessary to help victims of sexual assault, survivors of sexual assault. That was the message this week as Mayor Lenny Curry, Sheriff Mike Williams, and State Attorney Angela Corey all joined together and spoke out at a special event at City Hall about efforts to reduce a backlog of untested sexual assault kits in this area. There's a similar effort happening all around the state. Now, here on the First Coast, a multi-million dollar grant has been awarded to the prosecutor's office to work on this. And there's a multidisciplinary team, the only one of its kind in Florida. We begin the hour with a closer look at their vital efforts as April marks National Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Joining us now, three members of this city's Sexual Assault Kit Initiative Team, or SACI. Here with us, Teresa Simak. She is Division Chief of the Special Assault Division with the State Attorney's Office. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sergeant Erica Weber with the Special Assault Unit of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Good morning, Sergeant.
Morning.
And Morgan Moeller, who heads up the Rape Recovery Team at the Women's Center of Jacksonville. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And April marks Sexual Assault Awareness Month. What are your questions and comments about this new multidisciplinary team working so hard on this issue here in Northeast Florida? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show, or you can weigh in on Facebook. Teresa Simak, let's begin with you. This team first began in 2014, and a big announcement this week at City Hall about SACI, that's the acronym. Tell us about how this, all the pieces work together.
2 years ago, another division chief and I had attended a conference where we were listening to a presentation by Kim Worthy, who is a district attorney in Detroit. She was talking about their sexual assault kit initiative and the huge problem that they had there. We came back to Jacksonville, talked to Ms. Corey, got with members from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and began this initiative. So we started looking at what could we do to address the problem that was here in Jacksonville.
And we're talking about a backlog of untested rape kits. You've been awarded $3 million, roughly, to attack this problem. That's a significant amount. How much progress do you think you'll be able to make with the extra funds?
Well, the funds allow us to have a designated unit. We have an assistant state attorney. We have an investigator, a victim advocate, a site coordinator, and a prosecution support specialist. Mm-hmm. We are also able to fund two dedicated detectives from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Those people will work strictly on investigating and, when possible, prosecuting the cases that come out of the testing of the kits that have been untested thus far.
And give us a call with your thoughts on this at 549-2937. Sergeant Erica Weber, of course, the JSO's investigative powers are vital to this. Tell us a little bit about JSO's piece of this effort.
We have been working on the kits and the cases because the kits themselves are representative of a person. So it's important to remember that the person is behind the investigation in the beginning anyhow. But we do have two full-time detectives that are dedicated to this project. I also have a person that's in a light-duty capacity that's assisting us with the research and with gathering information and trying to help track people down. It's difficult to find people, you know, with a couple months' time having passed. It's even more difficult when you go back several years. So we've had some people that have left the area. We've had some people that we weren't able to contact in the beginning and we're still having difficulty contacting. I think it's important to point out, too, that this KIT initiative doesn't only encompass Jacksonville, although we do have the majority of the KITs. It also encompasses the other surrounding counties that are involved with our circuit.
Sure.
And one of the things that was announced yesterday through the sexual assault awareness kickoff at the Rotunda was that there is a hotline now that we've definitely, the state attorney's office has up and running, that's available for people who are wondering if their KIT is part of this process. So although all of these people will be contacted at this point, if there are questions, we definitely want to make sure that that hotline is out there and that people know about it to be able to reach out to us as well.
And if you're just tuning in, it's called the SAKI team. It's this area's Sexual Assault KIT Initiative Team, a major effort to test untested sexual assault or rape kits and stand with survivors of sexual assault. Let's speak now with Morgan Moeller with the Women's Center of Jacksonville. You're a strong advocate for being on the side of the survivors. Can you tell us a little bit about your organization's efforts?
Absolutely. So we are thrilled to be a part of the multidisciplinary team. And one thing that this group is working on is making sure that all of our efforts are survivor-centered and trauma-informed. So our multidisciplinary team, in addition to including representation from the Women's Center of Jacksonville as the Certified Rape Crisis Center, also includes a survivor who voices her opinions and feedbacks, having been through this process, to make sure that that is a part of all of our development of policies, procedures, outreach to survivors, because as Erica pointed out, this isn't just a KIT. This is representative of a person who was deeply affected by a violent crime. And we want to make sure that we're sensitive and trauma-informed in our approach to that and make sure that they have wraparound services. So at the time of notification, survivors will be provided information about our 24-hour rape crisis hotline, mental health counseling, advocacy support, all of the services that we're able to offer through the Women's Center of Jacksonville.
And April is nationally recognized as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. According to the Centers for Disease Control, one out of every five American women has been a victim of sexual violence. And how do those statistics compare to here in this judicial circuit? Teresa Simak.
Well, I think in 2015, we had 99 reported adult victim sexual battery cases. And I think that the research shows that maybe less than 20% are actually reported.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you could look around a room full of women and probably 30 or 40% have been victimized in some way during their lifetime, but very few people end up reporting.
And let's talk about the reasons why. Part of the reason, at least based on what some women talk about, is that they are skeptical that their rapist can be brought to justice. Less than 5% of all rapists ever see prison time. Isn't that right?
I think that that's probably about right. Right now, about 5% of the cases that we have pending mm-hmm. in our unit are adult sexual battery cases. They are difficult cases to prosecute.
And why is that?
There is typically very little evidence, if any.
Mm-hmm.
There are rarely witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
We rarely get confessions. So the forensic evidence that we're limited to is typically DNA.
And when you have a DNA match in a kit and you can get it tested in a speedy manner, that can make all the difference, can it?
It can. The unique factor in prosecuting sexual assault cases is that in most other crimes, we don't have to prove a crime happened. Someone is shot, someone is killed, a house is broken into, something is vandalized, people were robbed. So when we go into trial, we don't have to prove that that crime happened. We just have to prove mm-hmm. who did it.
Mm-hmm.
In sexual assault cases, we have to prove that what happened was a crime. And there is great difficulty in that.
Sergeant Weber, your thoughts?
The state attorney's office and the sheriff's office have a fabulous working relationship. There are definitely times where our standards as far as meeting a probable cause are not necessarily the same thing that the state attorney's office could take to court and get a conviction on or take to trial. So our standards are definitely different. But overall, we have got a phenomenal relationship with the prosecutors that are at the state attorney's office, and I really feel like we work very well in tandem with each other to make the best possible case that we can.
And Morgan Mueller, when you hear that as many as 30% of all women have suffered sexual violence, it's so unacceptable.
It absolutely is. And over the past 3 years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of survivors coming in for services. Our hotline numbers have tripled. The number of survivors who have received one-on-one support has increased by 60%. And we view that as a positive thing. We think that more people are getting connected to important services to promote healing and safety and get them connected with resources. Along the lines of prosecution rates, one support that we offer in terms of working with survivors is that we want to make sure that survivors have multiple opportunities to work toward healing. Criminal justice outcomes can be one opportunity to provide closure, but there are many other ways that we can work with a survivor to offer them support. And we do provide accompaniment throughout those processes as well.
And let's go to your calls right now. April is nationally recognized as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We want your calls and questions about a multidisciplinary team working on this problem right here in our own judicial circuit. It's 549-2937. Jim in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, Melissa and guests. Could you please explain exactly what a rape kit is, what's included in that? And my other question would be, is anything being done to make sure that the survivors are not re-traumatized by having this brought up again?
Two great questions. Thanks, Jim. Morgan.
Sure. Excuse me. So the Women's Center of Jacksonville operates the Sexual Assault Forensic Exam Program, which is a medical and forensic evidence collection program for adult survivors of sexual assault. So what's collected in the course of that examination are swabs from that person's body, from the areas that may have been impacted in the course of the assault. If there are injuries or potential injuries, we would photograph those areas as well, and potentially also collect clothing depending on the nature of the assault. So that evidence is collected based on the survivor's willingness to participate in that. They can choose to participate in all or part of the exam, and it's available whether or not that person is choosing to report to law enforcement at that time. So that information is then provided to the law enforcement agency of jurisdiction, who would submit that to the crime laboratory for testing in the event that the person was reporting to law enforcement.
And what about the second part of his question? When you work with a survivor, often in the past anyway, they might have been traumatized over and over again by having to tell their story over and over. There's been a more awareness about that in recent years too, hasn't there?
Yes. And one of the reasons why I think our team is unique and was successful in getting the grant is because this team is victim-centered. We have a survivor on our team who gives us that unique perspective in how we make decisions on policy and procedures for what it is that we do. And listen, we are working hard to make sure that we do as little re-traumatizing as possible, but it is a traumatic event in someone's life. It does change their life, and bringing it up again and bringing it out, unfortunately, may lead to the re-traumatization of some victims. But we have a great relationship with a women's center. We have our own dedicated victim advocate. We will do everything that we can to make sure that survivors are getting whatever services we can offer to them to help them through what is inevitably a difficult process.
And it's 549-2937 to join the show right now. Ira on the South Side. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning, Melissa. Another great, important show. Three quick questions. From a funding standpoint, is it the judiciary or the sheriff's office that puts money in their budget for the rape kit processing? Two, did former Sheriff Rutherford's Righteous Right Religious Beliefs underfund any of the rape kit budget items in his budget, and what was his budget for rape kits? And three, if going forward, if we're going to try to stop this, is any of this rape kit processing going to help Sheriff Williams fulfill one of his campaign policies or promises to identify and arrest the 37 gang-related leadership in Jacksonville? Thank you.
Okay. Lots of questions from that caller. Teresa Simic, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Well, first let me address the funding. No one has not tried to work on this problem. Funding is a reality that we all face every day. Rape kits are tested at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. The state of Florida gives funding for that. I don't know if it's in the sheriff's budget. I know the state attorney's office doesn't pay for rape kit testing. That's not something that we do, that is part of what I would imagine is the public budget for the state of Florida. Yeah. Testing rape kits is expensive, and that over, you know, the last 25 years has been a contributory factor, but not the only factor.
Sergeant Weber, when we learned that there were, I think the number was 13,000 untested rape kits all over the state, the legislature passed a law this session mandating that they must be tested now within 120 days. But as Teresa pointed out, it costs a lot to do that. How labor intensive is the process of just going through one kit? How many man hours? How much time does it take? How much money does each kit cost to process?
The kits themselves are processed by FDLE, and the charges for the individual pieces within the kits are that's an FDLE question that I'm not prepared to answer. And I don't want to give you misinformation, but labor intensive for us, we actually on the law enforcement side of the house, that same legislation says we have 30 days to get the kit to a lab, and then the lab has 120 days to test it. So from a law enforcement perspective, it's not changing anything that we are currently doing. My detectives now have a 5-day time frame to get to the safe examination office, pick up those kits, mm-hmm. and get them to our property room. And then from there, they've got less than a week to get them to our lab. So honestly, the legislation is not changing how we have been doing it mm-hmm. for the last 2 years once we took ownership of this issue. But I do think it's a great thing statewide, and I'm hope other cities and states, I say states, have legislation like this, and even less restrictive, more restrictive, just dependent upon the state.
And Jody's in Mandarin. Jody, thanks for calling in. Good morning to you. Go ahead.
Good morning. Great panel this morning. Great topic. I appreciate your giving some air to this issue, complex issue. My question is, I've noticed during the course of this morning's show the elimination of the word victim. And in my experience and understanding, the traditional recovery model starts with victim, moves to survivor, and then to thriver in terms of the recovery of the person who has suffered the consequences of the crime. In addition, we use the word victim when we're talking about other crimes. And so I'm a little concerned that that seems to no longer apply in the case of sexual assault, at least in the course of this conversation. So I'd like to hope for comments from all three of your panelists on that question.
Thanks for that.
On that observation. Sure. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jody. Morgan Moeller.
Sure. Excuse me. So in the course of criminal justice, obviously, there is a victim of a crime and also witnesses to that crime. So in course of active investigation and prosecution, victim is the terminology that's used. We view our role as the Certified Rape Crisis Center as empowering survivors of sexual violence and giving some of that power back is starting to, reclaim their identity and move from a place of feeling like all power was taken away from them as a victim into a place of survivor and, yes, ultimately, as your caller said, to a thriver. So we carefully address that language in our interactions with survivors and their loved ones to help them move along that continuum and to help them reclaim some of the power that was taken away from them in the course of the assault.
Teresa Simic.
We do still use the terminology of victim. We have victims, suspects, and defendants, and we do use that terminology within the mm-hmm. the bounds of our daily work.
And let's go now to Ricky on the north side. Go ahead, Ricky. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've got a two-part question. First of all, how do you guys handle victims that have been sexually assaulted or raped? And they get pregnant. That's the first question. The second one is that, when it's, how do you determine, because a woman can really easily accuse her partner or, you know, people that she has, associates with of rape just because she gets upset. So I know that's a very difficult situation, but I'm kind of curious as to how you handle those issues. Thank you.
Sergeant Weber.
Ricky, two parts there. Obviously, the pregnancy issue is real, and one of the things that can be offered during the examination are different medications to prevent that. But in the event that a pregnancy does happen, there's definitely options available to that survivor, and it would be their choice as to how they would proceed with that. And the second part of your question, which has now escaped me.
What about his comment, Morgan and Sergeant Weber, that this perception that a man can be falsely accused?
So what we know nationally about the data around false reports are that somewhere in the range of 2-8% of all sexual assault cases that are reported to law enforcement are true false reports. Now, as Sergeant Weber can elaborate on, there may be cases that are not provable cases, but that doesn't mean that the crime didn't occur. So to Ms. Simak's point, one of the issues that comes up in a sexual assault case is the issue of consent, which is an element of the law for sexual battery. When there are no witnesses in a case, it's often difficult to prove whether or not consent was provided, but that doesn't mean that an assault didn't occur. It just may mean that that component of the crime is not provable.
Is it your belief, Teresa, that when you're trying these cases, the onus should be on the accused or the accuser? Increasingly, the movement around this is insisting that women should be believed when they make these allegations, whether or not there's DNA evidence.
Well, I think the new national norm is to start by believing. I know that in our office, we work hard every single day to seek justice for victims of sexual assault and victims of any type of a crime, within the bounds of the law and the facts. We have a very high burden. When we file a case, we have to believe we have a reasonable probability of conviction at a trial. So that occurs in front of, you know, six people. And we have to prove to them beyond a reasonable doubt that each and every element of the crime occurred. So when we're looking at, and to relate it back to the false accusation, there is nothing more difficult in my job than to talk to a victim and explain to them that unfortunately we do not have a sufficient amount of evidence to proceed. And oftentimes it does come down to the victim said that it occurred and the defendant says, well, that's not what happened. It was consensual, or, you know, and we don't have sufficient evidence to legally combat that, then unfortunately we cannot proceed with prosecution. But I can tell you in the many years that I've been doing this, I have not personally come across a victim who has falsely accused someone. Mm. Yeah. So I don't know that that's, you know, I know that the numbers say maybe 5-8% of all that are reported, but I have not personally come across that.
And to comment on that, Ricky, I apologize for losing my train of thought on you. I would say that between the services of the Women's Center and the Sheriff's Office investigation, we tend to weed those out before they make their way to the court process and to the state attorney's office. I mean, the investigation can sometimes lead us to reflect that there was some inaccuracy that was initially reported.
It is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and we're so pleased to host all of you this morning. The work you're doing is so important, and we really appreciate you sharing this with our listeners. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Teresa Simak heads up the Special Assault Division with the State Attorney's Office. Also with us, Sergeant Erica Weber with the Special Assault Unit at JSO, and Morgan Mueller, who runs the Rape Recovery Team at the Women's Center of Jacksonville. Later in the hour, a look at DA's The Shadow Box on stage this week. But up next, how innovative therapies are helping local kids on the autism spectrum. Back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Karen Fagans. Everyone who donates to our spring fundraiser has a chance to win in our grand prize giveaway for an Apple Watch. The drawing happens when we reach $80,000. Find out more at 904-353-9528 or WJCT.org. Thanks.
Join WJCT at the Timaqua National Ecological and Historic Preserve on April 16th to explore the outdoors. Kids will have the opportunity to become a National Park Junior Ranger, hunt for nature treasures, win prizes, and more. Curious George will be on hand with Main Metal Recycling, teaching families how to recycle. This fun family event is free and runs from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Go to wjct.org/events for more information.
Tina Barton is an investigator who tracks down the brains behind massive scams.
We're talking about highly organized criminal enterprises.
But these criminals carry prescription pads, and they're cheating the workers' comp system.
We're talking about doctors who are being driven by greed. This is Hollywood-level stuff.
Next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Artists, would you like your photography, music, paintings, or poetry featured on WJCT? Submit your work to The Square, an online gallery and competition for local artists. Winners get a quality video produced by WJCT about their work. If you've submitted during a past round, you can submit again. Share your work now at wjct.org/thesquare. Presented by WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market.
Harold Ivey's brother left for the Korean War more than 60 years ago and never came home until now.
I'm feeling a little sad, but I'm also feeling happy that he's being returned home.
His remains were finally identified at a lab in Pearl Harbor.
These guys are near and dear to me because I know them by bone.
A visit to Lab K208 later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, innovative therapies have really gained ground in recent years to work with kids on the autism spectrum. One of them is music. Right now, as we mark National Autism Awareness Month, we welcome Dove Hagen. She's a local mom-trepreneur who uses music as therapy for kids with autism. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us in studio, Scott Benyako and his son, Andrew Benyako. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
In a minute, we'll hear about Andrew's story and his family story. But first, Dove, tell us about this program you've developed, teaching voice and music to kids. And there's even a summer camp, a free summer camp. How does music help children on the spectrum?
Music, I found, has been incredibly effective in creating cognitive synapses. And that just simply means that when we get to thinking in a different direction, the cylinders start firing. And it's like getting a brain massage.
Hmm.
And
I could use one of those myself.
And what I learned in using music and attributes, different attributes of music, in working with my students is they responded favorably.
In what way? What kind of differences are you seeing?
There are triggers that have been minimized or eliminated. The mood has been enhanced, which is always welcomed, as well as increased in vocabulary skills. So those are the immediate things that you will notice when having a child work in a musical capacity, whether it's with their voice or whether it's with instrumentation.
Scott and Andrew Benyako, let's talk a little bit about your family. Andrew, you're in fourth grade, is that right?
Fifth
grade, I got it wrong. So how has music been part of your life recently?
I really like to sing.
What do you like about singing?
I just really like it.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I think my voice is good.
I bet it is. It's fun, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
So what's it like as Andrew's dad to see this music therapy make an impact in his life and make a positive difference?
My wife and I started with Dove in 2012. We kind of got connected through the Heal Foundation, and we've been with Dove ever since. And one of the things that's been really great with working with her is seeing him grow, seeing his anxiety levels going down, seeing him become more self-confident as a person. I think that what Dove does with Andrew in sessions, it branches out at home, it branches out at school. He's gotten involved in chorus at school. So it's just good to see him growing as a kid. I think it's helping him mature emotionally.
And making a difference in his academic performance, too?
He's a straight-A student, yeah.
Wow. Already was. No?
Was and maintains.
And is.
Yeah.
So the music therapy is helping Andrew with a lot of other things that can affect children on the autism spectrum. Social interaction, anxiety,
yeah, the social
and all
emotional.
That.
Yeah, especially the social emotional because, you know, there are great days and bad days. But what Dove has done with Andrew is taught him to control those emotions, and we really see it. And his level of confidence with her is fantastic.
And you have a summer camp coming up for kids like Andrew. It's free.
It is free. Through my foundation, Melody and Harmony Music Foundation, I volunteer. And I volunteer my services to offer a means or a platform to integrate the performing arts with families that may otherwise not have the opportunity to incorporate the performing arts with their children. So the Butterfly Exchange is the umbrella program, and that's year-round. And I work in one-on-one sessions with children as young as 4 and as old as 18. And we develop their skills and hone their skills using various musical components. And the summer camp is the Butterfly Exchange Project. That is actually the band's name.
Oh, okay. Nice.
So the Butterfly Exchange Project usually consists of anywhere from 3 to 5 students. And they collaborate together to write an original song to original composition. And then they work behind the scenes to create a music video for that original song.
You're going to be doing that this summer, Andrew?
That's going to start the August 1st.
August 1st.
Yes, and you could find out more about that through my website, melodyandharmonymusic.org.
Well, it's such a great effort. Go to Dove's website and take advantage of this, because what an opportunity. It's so gratifying to hear about all of this progress. Thanks so much, all three of you, for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Interesting tidbit, you don't have to be a criminal for police to seize your property, you know.
This is when the nightmare started at Carl. We were singing Itsy Bitsy Spider to the baby, and suddenly we see sirens came out of nowhere.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Civil Forfeiture, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Aerothang, with Al Letson as the host, and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Aerothang, it's a new show, because we gonna do everything we want.
Aerothang. The opposite of nothing.
Classical music is available 22 hours a day on WJCT 89.9 FM HD2. Find out how you can listen to classical music by calling 358-6390. Enjoy classical music day or night on 89.9 HD2.
Welcome back. Big news for Jacksonville's own Schultz Center for Teaching and Leadership. They've been leading the way in designing a new statewide early learning training system, and it was their expertise in online learning that led to all this. President and CEO Deborah Giannoulis here today, and good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So how did all this come about? Because in recent years, the Schultz Center has really restructured what it does, and this seems like it's part of that.
It really is. It's extending what we know to be our expertise in online learning to larger, to other communities, and also to really refocus on innovation, which has been a hallmark of the Schultz Center from its beginning, almost 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So you have really started to pursue efforts not just out of Jacksonville, but out of state. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them.
This is one of them. We got a contract with an initiative in West Virginia that wanted to create an online network of training for educators and child care centers. Conveniently, we had moved into early learning and had, in fact, created online learning here in North Florida that we are now promoting statewide that gives teachers access to professional learning when they need it and when they can do it.
Everybody needs that, don't they? Not just teachers, but especially teachers.
Especially teachers. And because educators know best about how to teach, and what we know best is how to teach adults, we've extended what we know about online learning to all of the sectors, because we all learn online now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have a smartphone and the internet, you are constantly going to, you know, University of Google or YouTube, right?
That's
to
right.
Find out how to tie a tie or
my husband teaches himself songs on the guitar on YouTube.
I love
so,
it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
And so online learning is really meets the learner where they are and respects their time.
And so how is the Schultz Center really expanding that, not just with this contract, but in all sorts of ways?
We continue to expand in the education arena. We serve about 50 counties in Florida with online learning for teachers. And we've recently got a contract with a nonprofit that does training of home visitors for at-risk families. So we really think that this opportunity is something that we can extend far beyond the education community. But that will always be our heart and soul, because without teachers, the rest of us won't ever learn what we want to do.
And the Schultz Center from day one has been focused on training teachers, supporting teachers. Of course, it was founded here in Jacksonville by the late Fred Schultz.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone is aware of the vital role this organization plays in this community.
I think you will find a lot of educators throughout the surrounding counties who will say that the Schultz Center was the best professional development and recruitment device for many of the other counties in finding high-quality teachers. Because we focused on using expert practitioners to develop our content with us. We only have 9 people at the Schultz Center. We have an expert in technology. We have an expert in instructional leadership. We have an expert in event planning. Everybody else supports that, and all of our content matter experts come from the field, practitioners that we determine to be the best at what they do, and they do it every day. Mm-hmm. So we have a very boots-on-the-ground perspective and a cycle of continuous improvement.
You've been running the Schultz Center for how many years now?
3.5 years.
Mm-hmm. And I bet to this day people still come up to you and say, it's Deborah Giannoulis from Channel 4. But what a new chapter for you.
Well, it just happened in your waiting room, your green room.
Get out
of
here.
Fact.
Yeah. What happened?
Your previous guests and your previous guests and your guests that are about to come on all remembered watching me on Channel 4. As I like to say, we were pre-cable, pre-remote control, back when people knew what the letters, you know, VHS meant.
Oh, my gosh. That's got to feel good, though, though you've moved on to something completely different, a whole new endeavor.
I got into journalism, Melissa, much like you did, because I loved learning, and I particularly loved learning about my community. And I quickly developed a real fondness for educators because I knew that it was educators who inspired me. And I wanted to learn as much as I could about how we learn.
And it's kind of ironic, I never planned that I would run a nonprofit that focuses on learning. But when I think about being at the ribbon cutting for the Schultz Center, as
you
a reporter.
You were there the day it opened,
As a reporter.
Right.
And then reporting on the terrific leadership that was coming out of Jacksonville at that time. We were one of the only teaching academies in the country, and we still are. What's changed in the last 15 years is the physical place was imagined as where all the educators would gather. And that still can happen. But now there's this marvelous virtual space that truly extends learning and can give educators what they need just in time. We see educators going to Pinterest and Facebook. They're desperate to learn, to find strategies that help their kids. And we're going to continue to find more and more avenues for educators, expert educators who are right here, right now, not people we fly in from out of town or who sell canned content, but educators who are in these classrooms today who can assist each other.
And canned content is the worst. You want to steer away from webinars that are boring and that nobody gets anything out of.
How many people have sat for 2 hours and had someone deliver a PowerPoint to them, tried to stay awake, and then left with that sheet, right, that you can't read anything because the print's so small, that got lost either on the floor of the car or stuffed into a shelf somewhere? Online learning that is really high quality is what we do, and we make a big distinction between PowerPoints online and webinars. We don't do PowerPoints online. We take PowerPoints a lot of time that people have as their content, and we create interactive ways to have the learner engage with content, with their facilitator, and with each other.
Well, you are always engaging, and it's a delight to see you. And thank you so much for being here.
And if anybody would like to convert some face-to-face training to an online format, give us a call.
She's Deborah Giannoulis, President and CEO of the Schultz Center for Teaching and Leadership. And thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
The quiet part of our drive ends Friday. Do we have what it takes to make our entire goal without interrupting programs? It's up to you. Resist the urge to wait. Give right now, and we just might do this together. If WJCT is an important part of your world, help sustain it. Give now at WJCT.org or call us at 353-9528.
Coming to PBS from filmmaker Ken Burns.
Jackie Robinson was a superstar, but it wasn't enough.
Baseball was a bridge to the civil rights movement, so he said, I'm going to speak out.
He had a kind of fury in him.
Jackie Robinson took on everything we were afraid to face and changed the entire country.
If you only know the legend, you don't know the man. Jackie Robinson, a Ken Burns film. Starting Monday, April 11th at 9, 8 central, only on PBS.
After the city of Charlotte passed an ordinance banning discrimination against LGBT people, the North Carolina State Legislature called a special session and passed a bill overruling Charlotte's new law. On the next Fresh Air, how preemption by state legislatures is overruling many local laws, from fracking bans to paid sick leave. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
When you come back to the town, the historic Paramount Theater packed with 3,000 screaming snappers, when you come back to the place where everything got started, in front of your wifey, your friends, your neighbors, Lord knows, you better not come half-stepping. Snap Judgment, live in Oak Town. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, finally this hour, it's a compelling drama that first debuted on Broadway in 1977 and won both a Pulitzer and Tony Award. In 1993, The Shadow Box was the subject of a well-publicized First Amendment debate after a high school production was canceled in Arizona. But guess what? Our own local arts high school, Douglas Anderson, isn't shying away. They are doing a production of The Shadow Box, and it starts this week. Director Michael Higgins and cast members Avery Sedlicek and Preston Pittman here in studio. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good to see you guys. Michael, let's start with you.
Sure.
Why was there a First Amendment fight over this at a high school in Arizona?
Well, I think it was a rather progressive topic to talk about because you have a play about the hospice movement and Kubler-Ross's work on death and dying. And that's a subject seemingly so uncomfortable for people that I think they thought, oh, teenagers especially don't want to be connected with that topic at all.
They thought it was too heavy for high school
kids.
Too
heavy, yes, dealing with that kind of grief.
Avery, Preston, this story focuses on three different families. Each has someone who's dealing with terminal cancer. It doesn't seem as though it's too heavy for Douglas Anderson, yeah?
No. Well, I think the big thing of why it doesn't seem too heavy is because there's a lot of other aspects that we're focusing on, the hope of life and the celebration of life and things like that. So there's lots more points than just those dark moments.
Preston, tell us a little bit about your part in the show.
Well, I play a character named Mark, and he comes from a little bit of like a rougher background, and someone finally gives him hope and gives him a place to stay and really just comforts him and gives him hope and a life on the right track, per se.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just kind of the playing out of that aspect and the dealing with the death of someone who gives him so much life and so much to live for.
You know, Michael, when people come to see this production, I think they'll be not only so impressed by the quality of it and the talent at Douglas Anderson, but it sounds as though they'll learn something about the hospice movement. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. We're going to have, in fact, on our opening night Thursday, we have a couple doctors coming from Mayo Hospital and from the chaplains from some hospital to do a panel after the show talking about hospice movement and how it's changed over the years and what its function is in the community. I think it's a topic that actually teenagers have had grandparents and relatives in hospice, but there's sort of a shame or an uncomfortableness in talking about the subject, so we hope to bring that to light.
And when you say it's changed over the years, what have been some of those changes?
I think it's more part of the community rather than some building hidden in the back of a community that people were very quiet about. Now it's out in the front getting money donated to it, having lots of fundraising for it, and a very comfortable, common thing to talk about, the beauty of what the movement is.
Avery, do you feel like this play will start a conversation in this community about this?
I mean, I think it'll definitely start a conversation. I don't think that it would start. I think it'll just open people's minds to the way that they see death and the way that they see life, and I really hope it'll inspire people to get out there and make the most of every moment of their life.
It's a serious subject matter. Is it ever depressing for you both to rehearse these scenes, or are you enjoying it?
No. I don't ever think it's depressing because, like I said, at the end of the play, it really caps off with a high note of hope. So I think it could get downtrodden and kind of dark, but I think you have to really work not to.
Yeah, and especially because it's, in a way, it's a release because death is such a taboo topic in younger ages, but really we experience it just as much as anyone else. Mm-hmm. But for us, it's harder because we're not allowed to express how we feel about it. And through this play, we can finally just let some of that angst and that anxiety out about how we actually feel.
Well, you're both so impressive. Do you plan to pursue theater when you go on to college? You're both seniors?
Yes, without ma'am. A doubt.
Yeah. Do you know where you're going to school yet?
Yes, ma'am. I'm going to be attending Shenandoah University in Winchester, Virginia.
Congratulations. How about you, Preston?
I'm going to take the year off and then audition for schools next year and just see where life takes me.
Well, Michael Higgins, the director, you've got some very talented kids in this production. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm very lucky.
And The Shadow Box debuts Thursday night at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts in the Black Box Theater, and it runs through April 16th. How can people get their tickets?
They can get their tickets through showing up at the door at Douglas Anderson, usually an hour before. Our online sales have sort of finished up, and now we have good seating right there at the door.
Come on out and see The Shadow Box beginning Thursday night at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. Cast members Avery Sedlacek and Preston Pittman and director Michael Higgins. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You got out of a little bit of class today, too.
That's true.
How about that? And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and you can now watch the show now at our partner TVJax.com. Also segments at MetroJacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, the Wisconsin primary, analysis of the results, prospects for Donald Trump's path to the GOP nomination, and the delegate battle between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.